For the last couple of years, I've been trying to sort out how Harvey Weinstein derailed the career of Alfonso Gomez Rejon.
Yeah, believe me, I wanted to take you out to dinner and talk about it for hours because the stories were surreal and never-ending, but it was a time where it was so uncertain what was going to happen.
Today, the filmmaker talks. Morrissey's at the Hollywood Bowl tonight, but some fans are staying away because of the singer's embrace of white nationalists.
Should it just be about what he sings about rather than what he talks about? It's painful.
And Taika Waititi won't apologize for the Nazis in his film, Jojo Rabbit.
If I wanted to have pleased every single person with this film, it would not be this film, and it would not be one of my films, and it would be boring.
All that and actor Robert Pattinson on the Frame Weekend from the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC. I'm John Horn. We'll be right back. Welcome to the Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. On this show, we talk with creative people about how and why they do what they do and about how their art is impacted by the wider world. A little later on the show, how director Alfonso Gomez Rejon got his movie out from the clutches of Harvey Weinstein and into theaters. We're going to start today with an actor. His name is Robert Pattinson. He was in the Twilight movies, and you might have seen that he's going to play the next Batman.
Makes me feel free in a way I've never known.
The movie is not out for a couple of years, 2021. If you want to see Pattinson now, you can catch him in The Lighthouse, but be warned, hardly a superhero film, and definitely unlike the Twilight movies that made Pattinson a worldwide heartthrob. The Lighthouse is a black and white surreal drama. It's from filmmaker Robert Eggers, who made The Witch. It stars Pattinson and Willem Dafoe. They're stuck on a remote New England island in the 1890s. They play lighthouse keepers, and there's nobody around to help them.
It used to be two guys in a lighthouse, and then they used to always kill each other or go mad. So it ended up being three. I mean, who I'm playing in it is someone who's kind of essentially on the run. And it's an element of the Wild West working there, I guess.
You could also argue in some ways it's like two astronauts in space traveling to Mars. They can't leave. They're stuck.
Exactly, yeah. And 4 weeks suddenly seems like 5 years, which is kind of one of the parts of the movie.
The Queen of England's old fancy housekeeper couldn't even done no better than what I done. Because I tell you, I scrubbed this here place twice over.
And I say you did nothing of the sort. And I say, you swab it again, and you swab it proper like this time, and you'll be swabbing it 10 times more after that.
The conceit of the movie is that your character and Willem Dafoe's character have different stations on this station, that he is the boss, and he gets to go places that your character doesn't. He has more experience, he has more knowledge, and he's very possessive of those things. And it got me thinking about the relationship between actors playing those characters, that there's the dynamic in the story and there's the dynamic of how people approach acting, and they may be very different.
I mean, the good thing about only having two people in something, it makes it a lot easier. I mean, I don't think me and Willem really approach stuff that differently anyway. I feel like he just has a lot of control over his technique, whereas I don't know. I feel like I'm really just like rolling the dice a lot. Like I'll try and get my body to feel it, and then hopefully something comes out afterwards. Whereas I think Willem can really have a plan and stick to it as well and achieve what he's trying to achieve. Whereas I'm not entirely sure what I'm trying to achieve. I'm just kind of hoping that something happens and throwing yourself, just jumping off a cliff, basically.
I want to back up and ask you about watching The Witch and about seeing that film and about what you took away from Robert Eggers' first feature.
I'm always kind of looking for someone who's just doing something very original, basically. And The Witch was strikingly original. And then I wanted to work with Robert about, I guess, 4 years ago or something, about a sort of medieval epic, which he was wanting to do about a knight. And the budget ended up being massive and it kind of never got together. And then we kind of went through doing Nosferatu. I was sort of into it, but I thought it was a little bit too close to home playing a vampire. But then I thought
done that vampire thing before.
Yeah, but I thought maybe that's kind of genius to do. Just do it again. But then that kind of didn't come together. Then this came up, and I just thought there's always something that appeals to me about very, very specific colloquial dialect. The more movies I do, I think the first thing I connect to as in a part is just how a character speaks, and then everything kind of comes out of that.
We're talking with Robert Pattinson about his film The Lighthouse. I want to ask you more about that idea about finding a character through dialogue. Mm-hmm. Is it something that you find organically? And once you figure out the dialect, do the physical traits of the character start to reveal itself?
I had a little tape of some lobster fishermen from Maine, and there's something about there's little areas of Maine which kind of have pockets of an accent which kind of sounds, I mean, it doesn't sound like you're in America at all. I sort of thought that was really fascinating. It was something kind of, it was almost sound like an English West Country accent or something, and it's just survived completely intact, doesn't change for hundreds of years.
Tell me, what's a timberman want with being a wiki?
Just looking to earn a living, just like any man. Starting new.
On the run.
There were just a couple of syllable sounds which then just sort of tickled me a little bit, and I tried to sort of shove that into the script when I was reading it, and then suddenly something clicked. I mean, you suddenly realize because of the way your mouth has to form a syllable, it sort of changes your facial expressions, and then it starts to kind of contort your body a little bit. It feels very natural at the time.
But it works for you.
And it really works. And it's kind of, but then you end up, I mean, some of the stuff I was doing to kind of get into it in The Lighthouse was just, I mean, really on the cusp of unprofessional. you're contorting yourself every which way.
In terms of how you would prepare for a scene or how you would actually do the scenes?
Well, to do them, and it was kind of, I guess because a lot of them are very, very, very adrenalized scenes as well, but there was something about how difficult that accent is to stay in it that it informed the character as well, because it's kind of, you could slip into something else so easily. And then I like the idea of just someone who's so uncomfortable with his own reality that you're trying to twist out of it the whole time, and it's some kind of, you know, you sort of become a kind of Houdini kind of thing.
I mean, that sounds like in some ways a difficult idea to play, because what you're describing is somebody who is not really understanding who he is and what he's doing.
Yeah. And I remember asking Robert a lot, saying like, is this happening in his mind? Is it a magical island? Again, it's kind of, and one of the first conversations I had with Robert, I just asked him how he'd come up with the story. And he was just saying, I have no idea. Something happened, because it's so bizarre. I mean, in so many ways, it's kind of like when you've had a dream, and if you wake up and you can kind of think like, oh, I had that dream because of this memory and this thing happened. But then sometimes you have a dream when you wake up and you're like, where did that come from? And a dream that causes you to question everything about your own existence.
Let me ask this last question. What do you enjoy about acting? And how would you describe the satisfaction you get from performing?
I mean, there's different facets of it. I love that the free fall aspect of when you're actually performing. It's kind of, you can do all this prep, but then, I don't know, it feels like, what's the Olympic sport when you're doing tumbling?
Gymnastics?
Yeah, when you literally just have the kind of the mat and you're just flipping on the mat.
Floor exercise.
Floor exercise,
and
yeah.
Gymnastics, yes. You're just spinning around.
Yeah, and it kind of feels like if you can do the run-up, but once you're flipping, like, it's kind of, you just have to hope.
You can either stick your landing or go flying off the mat.
And there's something very exhilarating about that, especially when you've prepared correctly.
Robert, thanks so much for coming in.
Cool, thanks a lot.
Robert Pattinson is in The Lighthouse opposite Willem Dafoe. It's in select theaters now. You're listening to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. Game of Thrones is gone, but HBO might be dominating Sunday nights again, this time with a series called Watchmen. Aside from impeachment testimony in Washington and fires raging in California, this series seems to be the thing that everybody is talking about this week. Watchmen is created by Damon Lindelof. You might know him from Lost and The Leftovers. And it's based on a graphic novel set in New York in the 1980s. Soraya Nadia McDonald is the culture critic for The Undefeated, and she's been writing about the show. Hey, Soraya.
Hi, John.
So the HBO Watchmen is set in Tulsa, Oklahoma, unlike the graphic novel or the 2009 movie. Why is that an important choice?
It's set in Tulsa, Oklahoma, because of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre that takes place in a business district of Tulsa called Greenwood. This is an event that actually took place in American history in real life, not just in this sort of superhero universe. And it was this massive act of racial terrorism. A white mob chased black protesters into the Greenwood neighborhood in 1921 at the end of May. The white mob that confronts the protesters is armed. As many as 300 black people are murdered. Their businesses are burned down. It's really a horrific event.
More than 10,000 black people were left homeless. About 40 blocks of this neighborhood were left smoldering. And it's an important thing, too, in terms of the opening scene, I think, that we see in Watchmen, where we're inside a movie theater and there's a young African-American boy who is watching a silent film. Let's talk about what's on screen and then what happens after that.
This chaos erupting in Greenwood, and there's this little boy sitting in a movie theater. His mother plays the piano along to the silent film. This is what he's doing when this massacre starts to take place. And his mother kind of snatches him up.
It's time to go.
And his parents realize they might not necessarily be able to save all three of them, but they can at least save him.
We gotta go.
Be strong.
So they sort of hide him away so that he can get to safety.
And if you look closely, the silent film that the boy is watching is Bass Reeves, who is the first black deputy U.S. Marshal west of the Mississippi, and he's arresting a white sheriff. And he's a real person. So there are things where you can say, I didn't know that, and maybe there's a little hint of something, and find out what it is these things are in further detail.
Yeah, I think the thing that is really wonderful about this show and about Damon Lindelof's approach to it is that he has taken something from comic book culture and superhero film culture, which is this idea of Easter eggs, which are these things that are meant for sort of hardcore fans to be able to identify, sort of like a little nudge and a wink toward them. But they're also meant to inspire curiosity. He's expecting their curiosity will be piqued and maybe they'll do some Googling, learning about the history that he's decided to center in this series.
We're talking with Soraya Nadia McDonald about the HBO series Watchmen. So Alan Moore's graphic novel played a lot with alternative history, and the series in many ways picks up on that idea. The country in the series is run by President Robert Redford. Yes, that Robert Redford. And the president's treasury secretary is Henry Louis Gates Jr. But what does that alternative history give the creators of Watchmen in terms of exploring contemporary issues, especially those focused really narrowly on race?
President Redford has passed an act that offers compensation for victims of racial violence. Because of this, there are a lot of white people in Tulsa and around the country who are put out by this, form of reparations, basically. And so they refer to them as Redfordations. You know, in the first episode, you'll see when Regina King's character is introduced as this woman who owns a bakery. She's doing a demonstration for a middle school class. And as she's doing this, one of the children in the class asks her, basically, did you get the money to start your business from Redfordations? And this is not said in a nice way. And it turns out that Regina, by day, is the owner of this bakery that turns out to be a cover job for her because she is a member of the secret police of Tulsa, who have basically gone undercover and who now wear masks whenever they're on duty because so much of their job is concerned with fighting white supremacist violence. And 3 years earlier, nearly the entire Tulsa police force is wiped out when all of these police officers are murdered in their homes by members of this white supremacist group called the 7th Cavalry.
Which obviously has a lot in common with the Ku Klux Klan. I think it's fair to say that a lot of people who watch Watchmen may have no knowledge about the Tulsa race massacre and think it's fantastical that planes were dropping firebombs, but it's all true. And I'm wondering, when you think about the impact that a work of fiction can have on a contemporary audience, how do you think shows like this can open our eyes not only to our history, but also our present?
I think they can be tremendously important. When you have a show that's as magnetic as Watchmen is, and, you know, you could just sort of look at social media at 10 p.m. Sunday night after the first episode aired, and everyone is basically aghast. And so that means we have sort of a central point of reference to have a conversation about something that really has been, I would say, suppressed from sort of the larger common story of American history. You know, I mean, just this week we're having this huge conversation about lynching and what that means, because the president tweets that he is the subject of a lynching. And then you sort of have like this mass education that takes place online of what the history of lynching actually is in America. That's why I said that including something like the Tulsa Race Massacre and Watchmen, taking things that happened in American history that haven't necessarily been widely discussed, and not only discussing them, but really challenging the viewer in terms of making them think critically about who is shaping the history that we know.
Soraya, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Soraya Nadia McDonald is the culture critic for The Undefeated. She'll be writing a weekly newsletter about HBO's Watchmen. Episode 2 airs Sunday night. Coming up, are Morrissey's political leanings alienating a big part of his fan base? That's coming up next on The Frame Weekend. Welcome back to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. Halloween is right around the corner. Target has all its candy on sale. But if you're looking to get some scares, one place to go is Shudder. The streaming service is to horror fans what the Criterion Collection is to film buffs. But Shudder also makes original content like Creepshow.
A new generation of horror has arisen from the dead.
The anthology series reimagines the 1982 Stephen King film in 20-minute segments. They're filled with practical effects and a fair amount of blood and guts. Those are courtesy of makeup wizard Greg Nicotero, who worked on The Walking Dead, and he runs the series. Among the directors of Creepshow is Roxanne Benjamin, who was like a kid in a candy store when she went to Nicotero's studio.
You know, he's got all of this great stuff around that's just decades and decades worth. And his whole team, I mean, there's, you know, between all of them, like a century's worth of experience in doing this kind of stuff.
Did you grow up watching shows like Creepshow, or what was your was your entertainment diet when you were young?
Yeah. Well, I grew up basically in the woods in the Allegheny Mountains, right next to National Forest land in rural Pennsylvania. So there's not a lot to do out there. So it was I read a lot of books. I was reading like Stephen King and Dean Koontz and books like that, and all of the EC comics when I was like 6-7 years old, because they were the only things that were in the house, because it's also what my mother read.
Does that mean you're more inclined to certain kinds of stories? I mean, if you're painting this picture, I'm picturing your house and things that go bump in the night. It sounds like it could be the setting for any number of horror movies.
Oh, yeah.
Is that part of what your imagination was like when you were growing up?
Yeah, absolutely. And plus, it's, you know, this is like pre-internet days, and you're just kind of left with your own imagination. And this is also in a place where you were basically booted out the door at dawn and told to come back at sunset, you know, make sure you get back before the light disappears. And it sounds like I grew up in the 50s, because like we would ride our bikes into town and, you know, buy EC comics and Tales from the Crypt at like the local dime drugstore And it's it's very kind of idyllic childhood, I guess, looking back on it.
We're talking with director Roxanne Benjamin. There's a moment in your Creepshow episode where there's a glass object that gets wedged into, let's just say it gets wedged into a part of somebody's body, and that's grisly enough, but the sound effects that are added in post about what that object sounds like when it's pulled out are beyond describing.
The sound process is my favorite part because that's where it really starts to feel like it's coming together. Because when you're on set and you're making genre, so much of it has to do with the soundscape and with building that sense of tension through music, through score, through silence, and when to break that silence. So much of it has to do with sound. It's 50-50 on the visual and the sound. It's so important in genre, where I think that skews much more to the visual in straight film, I guess you would say. So when you're on set, half the time you're like, this is so dumb. This is going to be so stupid. I'm a failure at life. And then you get it into the mix and you get it into Foley and it starts to come together and you're like, yes, this is what I had in my head while we were there. And you just have to get past that piece to get to the real meat of it, which comes with the sound design.
These are vignettes, and you also produced the VHS movies, and you worked on Southbound, another anthology series. What do those kinds of stories give you that maybe a feature-length movie doesn't?
They're morality tales at the end of the day. At their simplest form, it's folktale. You're working in folklore and mythology in a way, and that's kind of the very basis of why we tell stories, I feel, is to impart some sort of lesson in life or something that you're supposed to take from it that is either to help you or warn you about the circumstances of life. And this provides a format to do that in its absolute purest and simplest form.
Roxanne Benjamin is one of the directors of Creepshow. You can watch episodes on the horror streaming service Shudder. This is The Frame Weekend, and tonight, Morrissey, the former frontman for the band The Smiths, plays the Hollywood Bowl, but a historically devoted sector of his L.A. fan base may not be in attendance. And that includes Frame contributor Stephen Cuevas. He has our story.
Recently, Morrissey has been more outspoken about his support for extreme far-right politicians in his native England. That's on top of inflammatory comments he's made in the past about Chinese people, immigrants, but there have been hints of Morrissey's more extreme views in lyrics going back for years, like 1992's National Front Disco, a song heard as a critique of extremist ideologies by some, but as a nationalistic rebel yell to others. It wasn't that hard for fans to let such songs slide, given Morrissey's championing of the underdog and the outsider. He criticized the monarchy and police brutality. And then last year came a controversial endorsement.
I'm not afraid to be called anti-Islam. And I'm not afraid either for us as a party to embrace that and go with it. It's about opposing barbarism.
Anne-Marie Waters is the founder of For Britain, a radical, far-right, openly Islamophobic party. It all went mostly unnoticed here in America until Morrissey performed on the Jimmy Fallon show earlier this year with a For Britain lapel pin stuck to his jacket. Morrissey's support of such far-right anti-immigrant politics is now roiling one of the singer's biggest and most devoted fan bases, Latinos, especially in the British singer's one-time home, Los Angeles. Come on to my house. Once a month, the cozy Boyle Heights bar Eastside Love hosts a Morrissey karaoke night, better known as Morrissey-oki. As usual, the place is packed with mostly Mexican-American fans queuing up to croon their favorites. There's also chatter about Morrissey's divisive embrace of far-right politics. Jaime, who asked that we not use his last name, is conflicted. He disagrees with the singer's coarsening views, but Morrissey's also kind of been a lifelong companion.
I think even back then I already knew that I was queer, I wasn't out, so I kind of related to a lot of what the songs were saying, a lot of these crushes that I was having on the boys.
But he also decided to quietly boycott the singer's recent LA area shows.
I struggle a lot, and if I'm gonna give my money, I'm not as prone to be like, here, I love you, take my money. You don't need me in your auditorium. Some people might say, well, then you're not a real fan. But that's my truth.
The cracks in Morrissey's fan base in the U.S. appear to be spreading, most recently during a show in Portland last month.
Go! We don't need you! Goodbye!
The singer exploded after spotting a protester who was hoisting an anti-For Britain sign and another that simply said, Big Mouth Indeed. A reference to one of Morrissey's biggest hits with the Smiths. Big mouth strikes again, and I've got no right to take my place to the human
race. I've actually seen him about 13, 14 times.
Adriana Chavira, a devoted fan and high school journalism teacher in the San Fernando Valley, stuck with plans to attend Morrissey's upcoming show this weekend in Hollywood. But she also wishes he'd answer for his more caustic comments.
I mean, I think it would be good for him to just come out and, you know, sit down for an interview, come out and set things straight. But I think he's always been very independent, and he'll just say whatever is on his mind, whether people agree with it or not.
Do you think there's a breaking point for you?
I don't know. I've been thinking about that, but I don't know. I can't tell you right now.
Professor Melissa Hidalgo, author of the 2016 book Mauslandia, Morrissey Fans in the Borderlands, and lead singer of an all-Latina Morrissey cover band, now on hiatus, reached her breaking point about a year ago when Morrissey threw his arms around For Britain.
Should it just be about what he sings about rather than what he talks about? You know, like, it's painful.
Morrissey's mostly kept silent about Donald Trump's hardline immigration policies in this country and his frequent attacks of refugees and asylum seekers. Though it shows in Mexico City and Los Angeles 2 years ago, his entire band wore T-shirts with Trump's name, preceded by a four-letter expletive.
I think this is his way of saying, look, I can't possibly be racist because I love my Latino fans and they love me, right? And so as long as he's anti-Trump, then that's good enough for a lot of Latinos as well. I mean, just because he's said he's anti-Trump doesn't mean he's anti the ideologies.
In Mexico.
For many Latino fans, myself included, it's all been pretty confusing and painful. After having kind of a take-it-or-leave-it relationship with Morrissey's music for years, a couple of songs I heard that he recorded in 2004 that romanticized Mexican-American culture sent me swooning.
But I could sense the hate from the Lone Star State.
After that, I was, I thought, a fan for life. But how could that guy, just a decade later, tell a British magazine that he feels persecuted after being slammed over his own xenophobic finger-pointing?
I was a good kid.
And that, quote, racism doesn't mean anything anymore.
I wouldn't do you no harm.
So as I flip through all my own Morrissey and Smith's records, I don't know what to do. I've not tossed any of them, but I also haven't listened to any in well over a year. I guess I'm just waiting for an explanation, an apology, something that'll ease the heartbreak of Morrissey fans around the world and right here at home. For The Frame, I'm Stephen Cuevas.
In the new movie, Jojo Rabbit, New Zealand filmmaker Taika Waititi takes on good and evil. But if you think this is going to be anything like his Marvel blockbuster Thor, think again. This film is set in Germany during the Second World War, and it focuses on a boy whose imaginary best friend is Adolf Hitler.
Poor Jojo. What's wrong, little man?
Hi, Adolf.
Want to tell me about that rabbit incident? What was all that about?
They wanted me to kill it. I'm sorry. I couldn't.
Don't worry about it. I couldn't care less.
But now they call me a scared rabbit.
Let them say whatever they want. People used to say a lot of nasty things about me. Oh, this guy's a lunatic. Oh, look at that psycho. He's gonna get us all killed. I'll let you in on a little secret. The rabbit is no coward.
The film stars Scarlett Johansson and Sam Rockwell, and Waititi plays Hitler, or at least a 10-year-old boy's imagination of what Hitler would be like.
It was interesting because it's not Hitler. It's some sort of amalgam of his father and Hitler and maybe some other father figures that he wanted in his life. And so that's really where that came from. And I wanted a best friend that was striking and really represented the Reich. And I wanted to show that throughout the film, you know, if you look carefully, like, you know, the buttons are falling off his jacket and his hair slowly gets more messy and, you know, sleeves start falling off on his jacket, which mirrors, you know, the fall of the Third Reich and, you know, and the complete and utter shambles that it became.
The novel upon which this film is based was published more than a decade ago, and you've been working on this film for a number of years. What kept you going, and how did you finally get it made? What changed? Something happened
between the first drafts?
Yeah, because a lot of people must have said, I'll use a euphemism, no, to what they told you when you started chopping it around.
There was a lot of enthusiasm for the script, because it is a good script. But, however, even then I knew it was a hard film for people to make. Not only because of this, you know, the humor element to it, but it's another World War II film. And, like, I think at that time, 2011, there'd been a lot. And also at that time, it was a period where the industry was focused more on actors being the selling point of films, and that they, to get the money, to get financing for a film like this, would need, you know, big names, very, very big names. And I think that if anyone big had played this role, had played Hitler, it would have really distracted from the whole point of the film and the message of the film and the story, which is these kids and, like, their story. And it would have just become the insert name here, Hitler movie.
And at this point, when you're first thinking about it, you haven't made Hunt for Wilder People, correct?
No. Nope.
But you have been thinking about and at least made one movie about underparented or unparented kids, which seems pretty clearly to be something that you're struck by.
Yeah.
And Cajun Skies, the novel, and Jojo Rabbit, the movie, seem to fall pretty neatly into that idea.
Yeah. Well, and I think some people would suggest that it's a focus more on children and father figures. But I feel like it's, most of my films are really about mothers.
You hate your country that much?
I love my country. It's a war I hate. It's pointless and stupid, and the sooner we have peace, the better.
Oh, the war will end. We will crush our enemies into dust, and when they are destroyed, we shall use their graves as toilets.
Okay, no more politics. Dinner is neutral ground. This table is Switzerland. Let's eat.
It's really about a boy and his longing for his mother and trying to convince himself that, you know, that his father's this fantastical person, and that, you know, that's really who he wants in his life when it's not. Very similar with Thor. You can see those elements in Thor. It's all about family, and I love the family dynamic. And so growing up with a single mother, I was, like, fascinated with what our dads would be up to, or, like, you know, what were their backgrounds and stuff, even though I knew my dad. But I grew up in an area with there were a lot of solo mums and a lot of, you know, a lot of kids from, you know, with single parent homes. And so it's all I knew, actually. And we would actually roll around in little groups and hassle kids if we found out that their parents were still together, because it just wasn't cool to have two parents. So that was all I've ever really known. And, like, I feel like the times I've tried to write families with two parents, I sort of get pretty bored.
We're talking with Taika Waititi about his new film, Jojo Rabbit. This film is very polarizing, and people have very strong opinions to the positive and to the negative. And I guess given the material that's expected, did you always kind of know that going in, that there are going to be people who would embrace this film and people who would reject it?
Yeah, I always knew there were people who embraced the film and they would be racist.
And it's either or.
No, I mean, it's... in America, people see the word divisive. They see it as a very negative thing. I know that if I wanted to have pleased every single person with this film, it would not be this film, and it would not be one of my films. it'd be someone else's film and it would be boring. But yeah, no, I always knew that there would be people who would not be in it, and fair enough. It is a hard subject matter to deal with, and especially if it's something that's very close to you. I did read somewhere someone said something like, oh, I don't think we're ready for humour with the subject matter, which is insane to me. I mean, there was one movie in 1939 which did it, and
The Great Dictator?
Yeah, so it's not a new, it's not a new idea. And I think what's interesting is like this idea that, oh, humour can't be used in a serious way, or it can't be used to fight against regimes and dictators, which is actually one of the most powerful tools that's ever been used. So I feel like I'm in very good company.
Taika, great to see you. Thanks you for coming to the show.
Thank you very much.
Coming up next, the leader of the band Everclear once contemplated suicide. Now he's embracing life, even as he battles a debilitating disease. That's next on The Frame Weekend. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn.
Our future's not going to be paved with bricks, but with copper.
The Current War stars Benedict Cumberbatch, Michael Shannon, and Tom Holland.
Switch tonight and you win.
His current kills people.
Only because you said it will.
The Current War tells the true story of the competition between Nikola Tesla, Thomas Edison, and George Westinghouse to determine whose ideas would power the nation. It was supposed to be the next big step for filmmaker Alfonso Gomez-Rejon, who previously directed Me and Earl and the Dying Girl. But Harvey Weinstein temporarily derailed Gomez-Rejon's career. It's great to see you.
It's great to see you, too.
When was Me and Earl? What year was that?
It premiered at Sundance in 2015.
Wow.
Yeah, and you were the first interview after my premiere. So I'll never forget that.
And I remember after I heard about Current War, I would occasionally send you emails saying, what's going on? When can we see it? What's going on? And that one.
And
after a year or two, I stopped sending them. It felt like, asking a girl out on a date. She was no longer interested. But I think there were other things going on.
Yeah, believe me, I wanted to take you out to dinner and talk about it for hours because the stories were surreal and never ending. But it was a time where it was so uncertain what was going to happen that it was best to just lay low and talk about it when the time was right.
In 2017, a version of the film, heavily edited by Harvey Weinstein, screened badly at the Toronto International Film Festival. Now Gomez-Rejon is releasing The Current War director's cut.
This version is all me.
I understand that.
It's important because I don't want him to redefine this new part
that.
Of my life. But I listened to some really bad advice early on, which is let Harvey into the process early during your director's cut and things will go better. All you do is just open the door and the notes start and the machine starts and you become quite vulnerable because you're not doing the work. You're not cutting the film. You're addressing notes and negotiating and buying time. And you have offices in London and LA and New York giving you lists and just to make him happy. And it just becomes not about your process as an artist, as a filmmaker, but about trying to keep your vision alive. So by the time you get to TIFF, you've lost a lot of battles and you're embracing and loving the stuff you got away with. But that's the big difference between compromise and sacrifice.
That you're answering to the executive, Harvey, rather than to the story, the film.
Yep. It's a force. He's a force. I knew that going into it.
So a couple of weeks after the film premieres at the Toronto International Film Festival, The New Yorker and The New York Times published their stories about Harvey Weinstein's long record of sexual assault and harassment. That is its own story, but what does it do to the film? Because there are a number of movies that are at the Weinstein Company that are suddenly put into some sort of limbo.
Mm-hmm.
So not only are you unhappy with the version of the film that you've shown at Toronto, but now the company itself is in collapse, free fall.
It was an incredibly surreal time because when the stories broke, it was before Me Too. There was this period where no one knew what was going to happen. And I was in the middle of the cutting room now, cutting in the offices here in LA, and the air is different. The half the people are you know, the cubicles are empty. So we did, we just quietly locked a cut as best we could. You can't be going in one wrong direction for a year and then correct the course in 3 days. But we did as much as we could and locked a version, and we're going to wait until a possible push of a month, which is, that's, you know, this is before it became something bigger. 1 month became six, became a year, and I never stopped recutting the movie in my head.
We're talking with Alfonso Gomez-Rejon about the current war. Early in your career, you were working with a director by the name of Martin Scorsese. And I'm wondering if people like Martin or other people were allies through this process and what they brought to the process that helped you.
Scorsese was part of my actual, he's a guardian angel of this whole process because he was part of my deal where if my final cutting rights or my final cut wasn't agreed on or there was some battle with the studio, that the final cut would revert to him.
So Harvey Weinstein can push around Alfonso Gomez-Rejon, but he can't push around Martin Scorsese?
Well, I pushed back a bit.
You know that, but Marty might have a little more juice.
Well, it was a chaotic time where obviously everyone wanted the best version of the film, but the version that matters is the one in the director's head. But and then it just abruptly ended without really coming to any kind of conclusion because of everything that happened. So Harvey wasn't even a factor in Scorsese getting the final cut. It was like a legal thing. And he was just kind enough to and generous enough to hand it to me.
The end of your film is about the creation of the motion picture and about Thomas Edison filming at Niagara Falls, correct?
Yes.
And I'm wondering, you have this coda at the film about the creation of motion pictures, and it almost feels like the making and remaking and release of this film could be its own film about the making of a motion picture. And at what point did you start to say art is imitating life, or the other way around, that what you are documenting in your narrative film in some way is happening to you in real time about trying to create a moving image and having so many obstacles put in your way?
That's a great question, because I've only recently started to see that part of that layer into it. Because believe me, I didn't think it was going to be this hard. But Edison's fight against Mother Nature and trying to defy it, and always looking ahead and not letting himself fail, was something that I could see myself going through at the same time, and even very close people around me telling me just to let it go, just move on to the next movie. This happens to a lot of filmmakers. But I couldn't let it go. I couldn't stop because it hadn't been ripped away from me yet. So there was still hope. But there was certain resilience and delusions of grandeur, I guess. He just wanted to not face reality. And my reality was so hard to even accept of what could happen had I just given up and walked away a year or two ago, which would have been a film that has my name on it, that isn't the movie I intended to make, that is surrounded with a lot of shame and negativity. And it affected me deeply, and that reality was too hard to face. And so I'm glad I kept fighting, because it is a triumph for really everybody. I'm there representing the cast and the crew, and so I feel a little bit like Edison looking ahead at the end with some optimism, regardless of how it's received. And if they republish the old reviews, I know that this is what I intended to make.
Alfonso Gomez-Rejon is the director of The Current War, Director's Cut. Alfonso, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
The Current War Director's Cut is in theaters now. To wrap up this edition of The Frame, we're going to visit with a punk pop star from the 1990s who is now back with a solo album. Art Alexakis, the frontman of Everclear, has a lot of heavy things on his mind: white supremacists, cyberbullies, and living with a terrifying disease. But as he explained to The Frame contributor Tim Grieving, this might be his sunniest album yet.
Art Alexakis shouldn't be alive. He grew up in Mar Vista project housing, raised on welfare by a single mom after being abandoned by his father. He was addicted to drugs by his teens, lost his girlfriend and his older brother to drug overdoses, and tried to drown himself off the Santa Monica Pier. But he survived, got sober, and in 1992, he founded Everclear.
You get beat up, you get up again. And that's the hardest part, is getting back up again. Doesn't mean you're going to win next time, but you're still there, you're still in the game. And that, to me, is everything.
Their hit records were Father of Mine, I Will Buy You a New Life, and Wonderful. Alexakis' lyrics have always been incredibly personal. Just listen to this song that he wrote for his oldest daughter. Gonna find a reason to hate me someday. Gonna find a reason to push me away. Gonna find reasons to blame me for your pain. His songs fused punk rock attitude with pop catchiness, and even, at times, lush orchestration and Beach Boys-style harmonies.
The intro for So Much for the Afterglow, which is like the Beach Boys-like intro, I went and recorded probably half of those and doubled them. And then I brought those guys in to double and triple with their voices on everything else.
He basically took that approach to the extreme on his new solo album, recording every single part himself at his modest studio in Pasadena.
This is the studio. This is where I recorded that record. If you came at any given time when I was doing vocals, I had this all walled off and a mic set up, and that was my vocal booth.
When I met Alexakis at his studio the other day, his pipe sounded much more frail, mostly because he was getting over a flu. But years of rock and roll have taken their toll on other parts of his 57-year-old body.
I have a bad knee and a bad hip. I got to get my hip replaced. And I couldn't play a kick drum like I normally can. I've been playing drums for years. So I did all the drums like old school, like you're in like junior high music shop, right? And I'm just hitting kicks and hitting snares like this. Boom, ta, boom, ta, boom, boom.
Notably less sturdy on his feet these days, people started gossiping that he was back on the bottle last year. That's when he decided to make something public. A few years ago, Alexakis was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis.
When I first got diagnosed, I read about the hot water test that they used to use to diagnose people. And I was like, man, people with these kinds of diseases, it's like a constant hot water test. You're constantly being poked and prodded verbally and sometimes in real life and sometimes just by yourself and by your own self-doubts. Like, chances are 50-50 that you're going to end up in a wheelchair. It's pretty scary. That was scary. My doctors told me that I had a disease. I will slowly fall apart until there's nothing left that looks like me. Like I said in the song, me and my wife called her and told her, and we both started crying. You know, and by the time I got home, she was like, she looked like she was hacking into Fort Knox or something. She had like three computers up on the bed. She's like, baby, we got this. We got this.
Besides openly addressing his disease on the album, Alexakis vents about the horrors of cyberbullies and Trump. One song is called White People Scare Me, but despite all the darkness, it's a surprisingly major key album, which is, after all, called Sun Songs.
And I wrote a song on the record that I'd never done before. It was like, I wrote a love song for my wife, Sunshine Love Song. I wrote a love song for my daughter, Arizona Star. And I wrote a love song for me.
It took a while to understand.
I got to tell you one thing about this disease, having this disease, it's really made me extremely grateful for just about everything. And I'm just so much easier to deal with. We're all going to die, and until we die, let's figure it out. I know that sounds super hippie, and that goes against my grain as being an avowed punk rocker my whole life. But I guess I am just becoming much more just take it as it comes.
For The Frame, I'm Tim Grieving.
He plays guitar in his car at night when he needs a place to be alone.
And that is our show for today. The Frame Weekend is edited by Darby Maloney and produced by her, Monica Bushman, Jonathan Shiflett, Robert Garova, and Julia Paskin. Valentino Rivera is our engineer. Andrea Gutierrez is our news clerk. Our intern is Paul Ratliff. The Frame's opening theme music is by Taylor McFerrin, and the show's senior producer is Oscar Garza. I'm John Horn at the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. Have a great rest of your weekend, and join us back here on Monday for the daily edition of The Frame.